I wanted to ask you, so today I asked you to come and do this event to kind of close out this day we've had thinking about the relationship between literature and social activism and global citizenship. And we spent a lot of the morning thinking about how things like literature can make you less prejudiced, literature can make you less racist. And this is actually like, so this was like empirical evidence by a social scientist that reading a literary text about Muslim Arabs measurably makes people less racist towards Muslim Arabs. But you're a writer, you're an editor. What do you think? Do you think literature makes people better?
I'm going to do that boring thing of going, well, depends on it. It's a context is everything. It depends. It depends on the type of book you're reading or the type of media you're absorbing. Because if you read, you know, there is this sort of type of literature about the other that we jokingly refer to as frangipani literature, where you kind of see like a sari billowing in the wind on the cover, and you read about people having quite Western problems, but in like say rural India or what have you. I don't think that necessarily gives you any more empathy with people that are other from you. I think so much of unpacking the difference between empathy and sympathy, or pity and the ability to dehumanize people. I think it's so much about not so much diversifying literature, but sort of almost decolonizing it as well, and taking it away from, I guess, the white gaze. You know, I think that you can't just read one book set in like during the Biafra War and then think that you suddenly understand all the plight of Africa as the country of Africa. You know, you kind of you need to spend a lot more time. And having a young child and making sure that she has positive representations of people of colour in books from an early age, and people of colour in books aspirationally doing things that all kids should dream of doing, I think that's much more important. I think that's the thing that gives you more empathy rather than the example you gave.
Yeah. But I mean, I guess then what interests me about what you've said is what would be the kind of literature that would do something good, right? Because I'm really cynical and I really am suspicious of this idea, right? And it's because of things like, I often find in teaching situations or in kind of doing workshops with people that you'll read a novel about Biafra, let's say, because that's actually something I do quite a lot. And instead of, and maybe you do feel some empathy, but I quite often find what happens with that empathy is then there's a sense of, well, now I know what it's like to be a Biafran refugee, so I don't need to worry about it anymore.
Yeah.
So, like, what do we do with that?
God, I have no idea. I mean, I think it's, so I, excuse me, I don't, just to sort of expand it a little bit, I don't think that diversity necessarily is about having the best books by people of colour out there or people from different marginalised communities. I don't think it's necessarily about having something that tells you one snapshot of one incident in one country. Like, true diversity for me is like average brown writers and really bad brown writers and okay brown writers and like brown writers doing like every single genre that they can. And you know, that to me is the thing that's gonna get, because I think what you're talking about is the thing that you know, there's sort of benevolent othering and there's negative othering. And I think what you're talking about, that is sort of benevolent othering, where that person is still removed from you, they're still other, and you think that you ultimately pity them for their poor lives, but you're okay. It's that there's this brilliant Teju Cole quote where he said, I'm paraphrasing, but he said he really doesn't like the phrase third world problems because it negates the Nigerians' agency to feel annoyed when they don't have Wi-Fi connectivity, and you know, they may have like worries about infant mortality or flooding, but they also will care about really banal things like you know, like haven't got enough credit for your mobile phone.
Like, my Pokemon Go just crashed. Yeah, I was about to get, like, a really good Pokemon.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Pokemon.
So I think we just strayed into something very personal there.
That maybe was a
I was quite a walk down from the university. Yeah. There's a very rare Pokemon on Park Street just by an original Banksy.
Was there really?
No, I'm just...
Was there? Because I was about to go. I was like, see ya. So can I ask you...
This is a Pokestop, by the way, the Watershed. I work at the Watershed. Or PokeJet. I don't know the difference. Why are we talking about Pokemon?
I don't know.
You brought it up.
Everything's about Pokemon. Okay. It's about capturing the other. Anyway. I thought it was really interesting how you talked about The Good Immigrant, the sort of genesis of the project, and how you were sort of inspired to put it together, and how you were inspired to contribute to it. What do you hope it does? I mean, do you hope it does anything? Do you just hope people read it and like it?
Yes.
Yeah.
I tell you what, my feelings about it have completely changed. So when I first started putting it together, it was pretty much just a way of getting some amazing writers in books, because that's how agents notice writers. They see them in a book, and they, or like the writer is able to go to an agent and say, "Oh, I was published in this book on this semi-prominent publisher, can you look at my work?" And the agent's much more likely to do it. And there were these writers that I really wanted to kind of give that leg up to. And then all the stuff around like diversity in publishing happened, and I was like, actually, it's a really, really important statement about the state of inclusion in books and representation in books. And then Brexit happened, and then I was like, oh God, actually, this is a really important state of the nation book now. Like, it's constantly surpassed my expectations for why I did it in the first place, to the point now where I think... And then we took some decisions, because, like, the readership kind of changed, like, as we got closer and closer to publication date. And I got to a point where I was like, you know what, I know... I didn't want the J.K. Rowling quote on the cover, because I didn't want her to be like the savior of the book. I wanted the book to sort of stand by itself. But then after the referendum, I was like, you know what? If a bunch of people will pick the book up because it's got J.K. Rowling's name on the front, and those are the people who really need to read the book, then so be it. I will hold my hands up to anyone who will criticize me for that. But you know what? I would much rather bloody Michael Gove read that book, or like your racist uncle at Christmas reads that book when you give it to him as a present, or what have you. Like, those are the people who need to read these stories and like ultimately learn to empathize with people who are a bit different to them.
For those of you who don't know, J.K. Rowling has described The Good Immigrant as an important and timely read, and I don't think you're better than J.K. Rowling, so you should probably buy a copy. I mean, I think that's interesting what you say, that you want people to read it like someone's racist uncle, so that they can actually empathize and see. So do you think it's about humanizing people?
No, I don't want them to empathize. Like, So going back to Ta-Nehisi Coates, who, I don't know if any of you are familiar with Ta-Nehisi mm-hmm. Coates. He's just one of the best essayists, and also is one of Marvel's first like black writers. Like, he's writing Black Panther at the moment. He's amazing. And I was listening to an interview with him once around the time that Between the World and Me came out, and he was talking about how he didn't write to make people... He didn't write to entertain people. And he didn't write to make people comfortable. And I thought a lot about that, because my first two books are very comedic. You know, they're comedy masking a darkness. And, you know, I really enjoy using comedy to really unpick some uncomfortable things. But ultimately, it is comedy. So there is, like, a safeness about it in certain bits. And I'd never really... sat down and gone, well, I'm actively happy to make people uncomfortable. And, you know, read, like, I commissioned all the essays and I edited them all. And, like, even reading all of the essays, and I'll talk a little bit about some of the essays in there, because there's some amazing things in there. Like, I felt uncomfortable, like, with myself reading some of the essays. Like, I found it really challenging, like, looking at my own behaviors. And you realize, like, how encoded in your own self, like, some of these things are. And I realized that I was happy to not make people comfortable. I want them to feel uncomfortable, because if they feel uncomfortable and defensive, then maybe it will start to unlock something in them. Mm-hmm. Because I think, you know, when we do exist in our echo chambers of say, liberal Twitter or the Daily Mail, we are still in those echo chambers where we're safe to mm-hmm. say whatever we want, knowing that the mm-hmm. things that we hear back could be the things that we want to hear.
Mm-hmm. So I do hope that you'll tell us a little bit more about some of the essays in there. But before you do, I was wondering, so I've been reading tons of stuff from you in like The Guardian, I've seen you on BBC, you've been all over the place talking about publishing, contemporary publishing, literary publishing in the UK. And one of the things that you've talked about quite rightfully is the lack of representation of Black, Asian, and minority ethnicity people in publishing.
And working class people.
And working class people, yeah. And I mean, there's probably a lot more demographics we could also touch on.
Yeah, yeah.
If you were in charge of British publishing, how would you fix it?
Hold on. Before I sign the contract, what's my salary and what are my benefits?
You're now the queen.
Okay, cool.
And you get her salary and benefits, but all you have to do is look after publishing.
Okay. That's more than the queen does, if I'm being frank. Actually, you know what, my theory about the way to... it's such a like utopian bullshit theory that it would never happen, but I kind of enjoy saying it. My theory on how to get more inclusivity in the arts would be if on Monday morning every single gatekeeper and commissioner, either in film, TV, books, like galleries or what have you, they all have to hand in their resignation with immediate effect, and then they will have to reapply for their jobs, but alongside everyone else who wants to reapply for those jobs. And we don't see your name, your qualification, there's no crappy equality monitoring form on it, we just get to see a statement from you on why you think you're the best person for the job. And then maybe we can have a bit more inclusivity, because so much of it is about the people who make the decisions. And like, so when we talk about diversity in the arts, often the way that people try and sell diversity in the arts to like major publishing or to people who work in TV is to talk about the business case for diversity. Oh, the brown pound, you know, or what have you. And I think that's really, really insulting, because it still puts us as a business, as like a marketing trend. Mm-hmm. It still doesn't address who's making money from our art, our thing. And that to me, like the business case for diversity is tokenistic compared to the social case for diversity, which is if we do think that books and films and TV and art and music all perform some sort of social function, therefore they should be inclusive by their very design.
I mean, that's interesting you say that, because I have a friend who we're connected on Facebook, and she's a fairly well-known Black British writer. And one of the things she's constantly complaining about on Facebook is all the invitations she gets for diversity panels. And she's recently been posting about the BBC has been hounding her to do a bunch of documentaries for them because we need a Black woman. We need a Black woman. Can you just do it?
Yeah, that's tokenism. Yeah. So the tokenism is when you find one person to fill a quota. Mm-hmm. Diversity is not having that problem in the first place.
And
that really winds me up. I've started refusing to do diversity panels. I'd much rather do a panel on, say, comedy and fiction, or like essay, like memoir, or just, you know, books. Like, why do I have to always talk about my brownness? I know I've kind of ruined that by doing a book that is all about race, but hopefully after that I won't have to, you know.
Do you think, though, there's any relationship between those two things? Because as an academic, you know, we often have similar issues in terms of what we're allowed to teach, what our curriculum is. And, you know, my thought is that my job shouldn't exist because I'm a lecturer in postcolonial writing. Well, actually, that should just be, like, integrated into being a lecturer in literature. But at the same time, I think, isn't it better to have something as opposed to nothing? But then I don't know, because I think you're right to say that tokenism is not the right thing to do. Diversity actually functions in a really different model.
Yeah. I worked with Media Diversified and an author called Sunny Singh to set up a prize for the best book by a British writer of colour. Mm-hmm. And because we looking at things like the Booker, which is, you know, because now it's including Americans in its submissions, you're starting to notice how many American books are being, big American books are being bought, and how few like exciting new debuts nowadays, like in the last 3 or 4 years, are from BAME writers. And so we wanted to have a prize that sort of celebrates them. But we've all said, and we've all said publicly, that our ultimate goal is to make ourselves redundant. We shouldn't have to exist. So, you know, we're putting loads of time and energy into this thing in the hope that it will celebrate BAME writers in a way that publishers will then see them as viable, or like they will feel much more empowerment in writing and know that there is a space that is there for them. And then we can go, okay, we've done our bit. Let's all go to the pub now.
That sounds quite utopian.
Yeah.
So Nikesh is going to give us another reading in just a minute, but I did want to ask you, and I kind of feel like you're begging the question, are you a good immigrant?
What do you mean by good immigrant?
Well, what do we mean by good immigrant? And what does that figure mean, right? Why is it important to have good immigrants and bad immigrants?
Well, I mean, we don't get to decide who is a good immigrant and who's a bad immigrant. And that's part of the point of the book. There is this sort of fictional scale, these fictional parameters that are made by people who with no accountability. And you can't just take the good ones, you know, and not look at your society and go, well, what about the bad ones, bad eggs here, you know? Maybe they've all moved to the Algarve, I don't know.
Well, I also wonder, this is a question I've always wondered, what does it mean to say that someone born in a country is an immigrant? How can you be born somewhere and be an immigrant?
Well, I mean, I'm a child of an immigrant, but I think that the whole argument when people decide what sort of immigrant you are, I think that they lack the nuance to go, well, were you born here or was your dad born here? I don't, like, if they found out they still want to voluntarily repatriate me to wherever I came from, which would be very confusing because my dad's from Kenya, my mum's from Yemen, so where would I go? India?
The Red Sea,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, so I think that Nikesh is going to give us another short reading, and then we're going to open the floor to questions.
Yeah. Before I do, can I just, because I'm going to read from Meatspace, can I just talk a little bit about some
yes,
of the writers
do,
in
please
the book?
Do.
Because it's not just me, and it was really a Wu-Tang Clan style crew effort. So we've
you
got...
You might need to explain that for the crowd.
So a crew is a collection of people... Effort is when you put time and energy into something. And the Wu-Tang... We all know who the Wu-Tang Clan is, right? No. Okay, anyway, so... So we had... as I said before, Riz Ahmed, who's in Star Wars Rogue One and Jason Bourne and The Night Of, which you should all be watching if you have posh telly, has written about terrorism and... playing a terrorism on TV and in airport... rooms. Varito has written a sort of a tongue-in-cheek guide to growing up to being black as she grew up as a mixed-race kid in Bath, as like one of the only black kids in her school, and she wanted to write something about that sort of coming of age that she spent the first 10 years of her life not knowing she was black, and the next 10 years of her life, as she says in the book, doing it badly. Nish Kumar is a stand-up comedian, and he wrote an essay about the time his face was used by right-wing trolls and men's rights activists as an image for an angry Muslim, and so he became an internet meme, and it's very funny. Daniel York Lowe wrote a piece about the 80s wrestler Kendo Nagasaki, and how Kendo Nagasaki was a massive hero for him growing up. And then he found out that Kendo Nagasaki was actually a white guy underneath the mask. And so there's a real variety of, you know, there's a mixture of coming of age stuff. You know, things like colorism, casteism are discussed. It's just a great book. I really hope you get it, really.
You can get it tonight.
You can get it tonight, the book. You can get the book tonight.
Do you know it's not out yet?
We might be edging towards the hard sell at this point. Okay, I'm going to read from Meat Space, which is my second novel. And I thought I did a reading of this in March, and I thought that was going to be my last ever reading from this book, but I might just do it now. So Meat Space is a book that's all about social media and the problem of living your life online. And Meat Space actually means our sort of our real life as opposed to our digital one. It's referred to, we're all in meat space now, so that's where the word comes from. I'm going to go awkwardly back over to the lectern and stand up. Okay, so I'm going to read from the beginning. So all you need to know is that I've asserted my moral right to be identified as the author of this work. The first and last thing I do every day is see what strangers are saying about me. I pull the laptop closer from the other side of the bed and press refresh on my inboxes. I have a Google Calendar alert that tells me I have no events scheduled today, an assortment of Twitter and Facebook notifications alerting me to 7 new followers, a favourite of a tweet thanking someone for liking my book, an invite to an event I'll never go to, spam from Play and Guardian jobs. Hayley Bancroft has sent me a direct message about an event we're both doing next week. Amazon recommends I buy the book I wrote. So what happens if you're constantly checking your Amazon sales ranking, if you're an author, is after a while, Amazon will want to know why you keep looking at this book and you've never bought it, so it will email you and say, why don't you buy this book? Which is what happened to me on the day that Meat Space came out. There's a rejection email from an agency I'd applied to do some freelance marketing copy for. I didn't want the job, but now I haven't got it, I feel annoyed and hurt. I think about tweeting, we'll write a copy for food, but decide against it. There's an email from my dad. He doesn't usually send me emails, he prefers text messages. It's a forwarded message from a woman on a dating website. In it, she's written, would love to meet your son and be his new mummy. In bold at the top, dad has written, Kitab son, when you free? ! I ignore it. I never want to meet one of his girlfriends ever. The only other two messages from actual humans are a friend request from the one other person with my name on Facebook, which is an important plot point, by the way, which I ignore, another important plot point. When I see the next one is from Rach, an email letting people know her new address. I wonder why she wants me to have this information. Am I supposed to think, oh, she's moved out of her parents' house, which, even though it was in Zone 6 and involved interacting with her brother and the cat that hated me, was still preferable to living here with me? Or more realistically, why is she moving out of her parents' house now, 6 months after dumping me? 6 months after moving out, 6 months after she told me she couldn't bear the way I lived any longer, and I was draining her enthusiasm for life. She's moving to North London, where she lived when we first met. I used to like meeting her at her flat. It overlooked a park, it had a big kitchen I would sit in while she made coffee with the landlord's Gaggia filter coffee machine. I put the brand name Gaggia in because I really like their coffee, and I hope that one day I'll do a reading and like the marketing manager from Gaggia will be there and he'll put his hand up and say, would you like a free coffee machine? So not tonight. Okay, fair enough. Where are we? She was clinical in collecting all of her things when it ended. The only trace of her was a T-shirt of mine she took ownership of while we were together, but I got full custody of in the breakup, and the chutney she left in the fridge. I hate chutney. It's a painfully white condiment, a colonial response to the spicy Indian pickle. I keep meaning to throw them all away. When she first moved out, I spent a drunken night spooning onion chutney into my mouth because that was the closest I could get to what she tasted like. The related Google ad next to her email is for housewarming gift ideas. I click out of my emails and think of things to tweet. I've got nothing to say. I look at the account of this other Kitab. I've known about his existence for a while now. 6 months ago, his Facebook profile started showing up in my self-Googling. I was surprised at first, another Kitab with my obscure surname. Kind of looked like me as well. He had fair brown or what I call caramel, ex-girlfriends are called dusty skin, and the hairstyle I had in the 80s swept into a Patrick Swayze cowlick of quiff and oil. He had eyes like mine, almond-shaped and coloured, and he had my mouth, full kissable lips. Or at least this is how I would describe myself on an internet dating profile. Caramel-skinned, quiff-black hair, almond-coloured eyes, and full kissable lips. The related Facebook ad on the search results page for Kitab Balasubramaniam is an identity-solving app, theft-solving app. It's 69p, I don't buy it. I wonder why he's decided to add me. I tweet, feet hurt, too much bogling last night. Hashtag bogling related injuries. The air in my room feels thick and musty. I try to remember the last time I left the flat. It hasn't been often since Rach moved out, except for the pub and for supplies. If it wasn't for Aziz, I probably wouldn't talk to anyone except for online. Actually, I left the flat yesterday. It was to go to the pub and do the big shop. I did the big shop after the pub. It consisted of beer, bread and frozen pizza for emergencies. Now Rach isn't here to fill the fridge with fresh, sustainable, organic food and chutney. I'm taking full advantage. I sleep with my quilt rolled and bunched into the sausage of a human body. She's my bedtime girlfriend now. I'm newly single. I call her Quiltina. Thanks.